From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, why the folks who write screenplays are caught up in a little real-life drama of their own right now. Then how indie musicians Inara George and Greg Kurstin, also known as The Bird and the Bee, found surprising depth in the music of Van Halen.
David Lee Roth, he was a real, like, wordsmith.
Also, his melodies and his phrasing are really exceptional. I mean, almost like Sinatra.
And film critics generally don't like faith-based movies, but does that even matter to the core audience for religious films? All that coming up on The Frame. The battle between the Writers Guild of America and the Association of Talent Agents is now looking like one of those endless Transformer movies. Thousands of WGA members have fired their agents, and now more than 300 of the town's top writers say they want new guild leadership. Wendy Lee is a reporter at the LA Times. She's been covering the clash between screenwriters and agents.
Those more than 300 writers that signed that letter, they are expressing their support for Phyllis Nage, as well as other officer candidates that have joined her slate, such as Craig Mazin, who is the writer on Chernobyl, and Nick Jones Jr., a military veteran who is also a writer.
I'm going to read you something that Craig Mazin wrote in a post about why he is running to be the next vice president of the WGA West. He said, "I'm also running because our current leadership, while excellent at starting this fight and organizing our membership, has fallen short of winning it. In the weeks to come, I will discuss possible ideas on how to win that fight." Are these candidates proposing a different strategy? Because it's not as if the Writers Guild hasn't been at least actively trying to figure out a solution to the current impasse.
They are proposing a different take on the current situation. Right now, the Writers Guild isn't entertaining the ATA's offer to engage in revenue sharing. WGA feels that there are two key issues on the table. Packaging, which is when talent agencies pull together talent for different projects and they get a fee for that, and writers don't have to pay a 10% commission, and affiliated productions, when talent agencies, either their parent companies or the agencies themselves, own part or all of ownership in production. And so the WGA feels that it's not worth engaging with ATA on those issues if they don't acknowledge the two key issues that are important to WGA. And the dissident contingent wants to reengage with the ATA.
A lot of the people who have signed on to this dissidence letter are still working, even though, like thousands of other writers, they have fired their agents. People like Craig Mazin from Chernobyl, Aaron Sorkin, the creator of The West Wing. Has there been an argument that the firing of agents has penalized a certain group of writers or up-and-coming writers more than established writers like Ava DuVernay or Craig Mazin or Aaron Sorkin?
Yeah, and you know, and I've heard things from people on both sides of that. So I think you know, there is concern from writers that what some people are calling the more vulnerable population of the Writers Guild, which includes some women, people of color, disabled, and LGBTQ writers. Some of the writers in this population, they might not have the established networks that more veteran writers may have. So without their agent, it may be harder for them to land jobs. And I have heard anecdotally of stories of people that are, you know, trying to make ends meet without their agents, and they're trying to, like, find jobs through other means, like social media and through their managers, to try to get work. And then on the flip side of that, you know, the people that are for the union's current strategy are saying that without the agents being sort of the gateway for jobs, that it opens the door to a more democratic way of finding jobs through social media and by entering into the union's online submission system, and that it opens the doors for more opportunity of people of color. That said, you know, there are thousands of members of the Writers Guild. I've only talked to a portion of them, but I would say of the people that I've talked to, I have heard a lot of stories of people saying it's hard to find work.
So on top of all of this, the Writers Guild of America has sued the four big talent agencies, WME, CAA, UTA, and ICM, and there's been some litigation that has come back from some of the agencies. Are the dissidents feeling that litigation is not the best way to resolve these differences, that the Writers Guild should be back in negotiations with the ATA and try to figure out if they can come up with a deal that way?
Yes, I think that they want to see this, the dissidents want to see this resolved sooner rather than later. And lawyers that I've talked to have said that, you know, if the lawsuits go forward, it could take years to resolve. So I think there's a lot of concern about that. That said, if the dissident candidates get elected, I have talked to some of the candidates running on the slate, and I think in general, they it's not like if they get elected, they're going to pull out of the lawsuits or anything like that. But some of them have said that they might consider things like settlement or try to finish the negotiations with the ATA and then, you know, wait to see the outcome of the lawsuit.
Yeah, I see people like David Simon, the creator of The Wire, has been very vocal on Twitter about the need to stay in the fight and to end packaging. What happens next? We have the elections over the next couple of months. Are there any scheduled negotiations between the Writers Guild and the Association of Talent Agents scheduled right now?
Not that I'm aware of, but the Writers Guild is engaging in individual negotiations with individual talent agencies, and we have seen, you know, at least three members of the ATA break ranks and agree to franchise agreements with the Writers Guild, and the Writers Guild is pointing to this as an example of its strategy working.
Yeah, but I think it must be noted that those agencies are much smaller
yes.
than the Big Four,
yeah.
and the clients they represent are generally people and shows that you might not have heard of. Wendy Lee is a staff writer at the LA Times, where she's been writing about the Writers Guild. Wendy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, Van Halen's music has lots of guitars and some sexist lyrics. So what happens when a woman covers the band's songs by singing the guitar licks? The Bird and the Bee is a musical collaboration between singer Inara George and Grammy-winning producer Greg Kurstin. The duo write and record their own songs and also cover other people's music. In 2010, George and Kurstin released an album of Hall & Oates songs. This week, The Bird and the Bee has a new album, and this time the duo is covering the music of Van Halen. On a recent morning, I visited Inara George and Greg Kurstin at his Los Angeles studio, and they started with how they were introduced to Van Halen.
Well, I heard You Really Got Me on the radio. That was the first time I heard Van Halen, and it just sounded dangerous, and I don't know, it just sounded like it came from this world that I didn't really understand. I was scared of, you know, and I saw the photo on the first album, you know, just the four of them, and I was like, wow, these guys are like sweaty, and but I loved them. They were huge for me, you know, at that era, that first album.
Inara?
Well, because in 1984 I was 10, so I was in the more of the later awakening, and I remember MTV was big, and Van Halen was on MTV all the time. And I can't remember what video it was. It might have been Jump. And I just remember watching it, just sort of being kind of slightly scared and slightly turned on at the same time.
I watched that video before I came over here. It's a lot of David Lee Roth doing the splits and Eddie looking incredibly handsome. And
yeah.
probably
He's
was wearing more mascara than
head.
You were.
That was the thing.
Well, people who don't know closely the history of Van Halen, there's two periods in Van Halen, David Lee Roth and Sammy Hagar. Your record is all David Lee Roth, correct?
Yes.
So what is it about the David Lee Roth era and songs that appealed to you?
Part of our interest in doing something like this is that it's just the sort of the universal reality that a good song is a good song, no matter in what genre it is. I mean, in David Lee Roth, he was a real like wordsmith.
Well, I feel like his melodies and his phrasing are really exceptional. I mean, almost like Sinatra in a way or something, like when their band is kind of doing their sort of swinging rock. I mean, it's like a shuffle they'll do or something. He's right in there, like in his feel and his rhythm and his phrasing is really authentic. It's not easy. I mean, there's a lot of rock bands from the 80s who were doing that sort of shuffle thing, but it wasn't as soulful as, you know,
David Lee Roth, an insane singer. I had seen, we were supposed to go to this concert together, and it was when David Lee Roth first came back to the band. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching the show, and just David Lee Roth kind of sort of blew my mind, because I'd always thought of Van Halen as like rock and kind of edgy, and then David Lee Roth had this, it was like, are you the best showman I've ever seen? Are you in Broadway or are you in a rock band? It was like this, he walks this amazingly fine line between the two worlds, and I kind of came away with it sort of this new breath of excitement for David Lee Roth.
You make a decision at some point that you are going to remove what is probably the most recognizable sound of Van Halen's music, which is Eddie Van Halen's guitar playing. So, Greg, I want to ask you about that decision kind of conceptually and then pragmatically, what it meant in terms of actually recording the songs once you make the decision to remove guitar.
Well, when I first got into Van Halen, I was the keyboard guy in bands. So I'd be learning these songs on keyboards, really. So I think that was sort of the initial thing, is I thought, well, I had already learned a lot of these songs on the keyboards, and it kind of, you know, I got into jazz later and improvisation and stuff like that. So, well, what if we can utilize that and I can, you know, take jazz solos instead of sort of, you know, arpeggiating rock solos to interpret Eddie's solo.
Let's listen to a little bit of your version of Eruption. So this is a song that to people who know the music would pose a challenge, because the defining sound of Eruption is the guitar.
Yeah, I mean, I really felt we couldn't leave Eruption off, you know, this album. I felt like it's such an important part of that first album, you know, and in hearing Eddie's guitar playing, you know, it's the first time I've heard anyone really do that. It was very innovative. But I also, listening more closely to, you know, Eddie's version, I realized that it's really like a classical piece of music. There's these arpeggios and there's chord movement, and I thought it would really work on piano.
We're talking with Inara George and Greg Kirsten about their new record of Van Halen covers. Did you rediscover parts of the songs in redoing them that had never struck you before? That maybe there was a message or a theme to some of their songs that you'd completely missed the first time around?
I think because in my kid mind, Panama, it was like I was learning about the Panama Canal when I heard that song. So I really thought it was about the Panama Canal. And then you read the lyrics, you're like, oh no, it's about a girl in a car. Of course. But that was, I think it's like, it makes you realize like you've heard a song so many times and you don't actually listen to the lyrics. And there is some music like that. I think Van Halen sort of is in that category for me.
We're going to kind of recreate how you guys put together Panama. So do you remember that day?
This is the thing about these records, these cover records, is really, it's like Greg's kind of brainchild. Because when we make our records where we write, a lot of business happens when we're together. But I feel like this, I don't even remember if I was even around when you like got this one going on.
You were definitely around on the vocal parts, that's for sure.
Yes, I was here.
So I could show you some proof of that. Basically, we would use Inara's voice to kind of recreate a lot of the guitar parts. That was sort of the initial idea. So we have this section, which is the intro, and kind of a little Beach Boys inspired, but here's this soloed up. This is an aura stacked. And then it does the little piano thing, and then you have Inara playing the actual main guitar riff, but kind of reharmonized with a little bit of a jazz kind of voicing to it. So let me see what else we have.
That bass, the
funky bass.
The funky bass line.
Let's see if I could find that. So we have basically the chorus that's sounding like this. I'll solo up some. So this is all the music. You have the vocals happening. And then you have like a bass thing going on. What else is here? Well, here's the mini Moog bass. This is without the drums and bringing the drums and everything. That's pretty much what's going on there. And then when you get into the solo section, let's see what's going on here. Also there, I sampled Inara's voice from the intro, but pitched it up to a different key to kind of fit the key of this part of the song. Then you have this kind of like new wave piano going on here, which is just reminds me of the 80s.
And then that section all together, let's hear that.
Okay.
Yeah, we're running a little bit hot tonight.
Yeah, Inara. Then you have these kind of ascending chords, which I kind of put chords to, which I don't think Eddie really plays exactly those voicings, but I kind of filled out the voicings a little bit more. That's pretty much it, you know? Yeah.
I'm curious, when you're taking it apart musically, does it change in its meaning lyrically?
I think what was the exciting part about doing this is that this is such a kind of male-focused lyrical. I mean, this song in particular, it was that he is with a woman and he is equating the car and the female together. So I was equating the car as more of a masturbation piece.
As opposed to a sex car.
A sex car, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sex car, but it's a solo sex car.
When you work on a project like this, does it get you thinking about ways you can arrange your own songs?
Yeah. I mean, well, I feel like just really studying someone else's music, you know, I mean, we did that with Hall & Oates and then the same with Van Halen. These are such great pop songs, and seeing how the songs work, you know, besides taking sort of the rock element out of it, you know, and sort of just looking at them as songs, I think we really learned a lot about, you know, like, oh, you can approach a song like this, you know, and today's songwriting, there's a lot of formula going on. And so these are great songs that don't really follow any of those formulas. And so it's just nice to be reminded of that.
Inara and Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Bird and the Bees Van Halen album is out August 2nd. The band performs that night at the Ford Amphitheater. Next on The Frame, why critics don't bless faith-based movies. Faith-based films, movies that tend to focus on belief in God or Christianity, have been a small but significant chunk of the cinema box office for years. But even as the genre has grown, the response of critics to those message movies has remained, well, a little less than heavenly. Is it bias, or are these just bad movies? The Frame contributor Colin Friesen went looking for answers.
When I try to talk about my faith, it's like, well, they just make fun of me.
I don't think God expects you to go anywhere where you don't fit in.
Faith-based films or movies with overt Christian themes may rightly feel a little persecuted by critics. A recent study of Rotten Tomatoes reviews found that while the average rating for all films last year was 57% positive, the average of even the highest grossing faith films was about 20 points below that.
God-awful movies.
The podcast God-Awful Movies has reviewed hundreds of these offerings. co-host Noah Lusions, and yes, it's a stage name, says the recent rush of these movies started when the 2014 movie God's Not Dead turned out to be a surprise hit, spawning God's Not Dead 2 in 2016 and God's Not Dead A Light in the Darkness just last year. Now, big names like Disney, Sony, Fox, and TriStar have jumped into the game, but most of the cinematic canon is modestly budgeted indies from producers you've never heard of, and it's here Lusions and his crew find their targets. His favorite example? The final moment of God's Not Dead, where an atheist is run over by a car and lies dying in the street.
At the last second, a pastor runs up to him and offers him an opportunity to turn his life over to Jesus and get to heaven after all.
I believe it's God's mercy that brought me here right now. But I'm here to tell you that it's a gift. Because the God that you don't believe in has given you another chance. Another chance to change your final answer.
And then he does, and he dies right in front of him, and everybody stands around remarking about what a great day that was then. I guess if you're a person of faith and you're like, well, that guy went to heaven now, that's probably a really uplifting message to a person like myself. That's a dying man being harassed on the street with the last breath of his life, you know, and then having his death celebrated by a bunch of strangers.
For critics like Amy Nicholson, co-host of the podcast Unspooled, the more general sin of a faith-based film is boredom.
They are a genre. You know, they have their tropes. Basically, every inspirational type of Christian film is going to fall into this kind of pattern where there's a brush of death, there's some element of forgiveness, and the protagonist is brought closer to their faith by the end of it. It's very beat, beat, beat. The faith-based genre has been going on so long, it's basically at the point now where, if we were talking about the genre 80 slashers movies, we're like at Friday the 13th, part 7. So yes, there is a general exhaustion with these films when critics do see them.
Doesn't bother me even a tiny bit.
That's Ted Gartner, a partner at Grace Hill Media. The firm has handled marketing campaigns for 300 faith-based and more mainstream films. Gartner says he's not sure most critics have the faith-based background to understand what they're seeing.
You know, I think it is very hard, you know, when you are critiquing other dramas, and this is your business all the time, and then you get into these niche things that don't fit that, and they don't fit the same kinds of scripts and dialogue that you're used to, or, you know, histories, you know, taking into consideration what they grew up in. Just like, you know, I don't get all the jokes in a Tyler Perry film. No, that's not a negative to them. It's just, it ain't their gig.
But some films do manage to land with critics.
Cindy.
John!
He's been underwater for more than 15 minutes. It's going to be a recovery, not a rescue.
The Fox Disney release Breakthrough came in at 60% fresh on the Rotten Tomato meter. It was also a film that let a pastor say the word hell, not as a noun, but as an interjection, and raised the theological issue of why God saves some people and not others. Grant Niporti is the screenwriter, who's also written secular films like 7 Pounds, which starred Will Smith. Niporti says most of the time, reviewers get it right.
We have a quality problem. Historically, I think sometimes there can be a critic with an axe to grind, but I think on the whole, the criticism of some of the faith-based films over the years is warranted. And they're more message, trying to deliver a message than deliver great entertainment.
That may be because of the unwritten rules many of these films choose to follow. Saying anything more theologically complicated than God exists can alienate different branches of the faith, so the messaging is kept incredibly generic. And when your film has to be suitable for family viewing, dealing with real adult issues is tricky at best. And no illusions from the God Awful Movies podcast says there's also the superhero problem.
Now you can see this like become a problem even in like, I don't know, comic book movies or fantasy movies where you have that one superhero that's just too powerful, and if they're there, obviously they could take care of everything easily. So you always have to get Professor X kidnapped or something during the main Act 3 battle. You can't do that with God, right? You can't get him kidnapped or distracted or written out. So very often, these poor writers are stuck with a genre that insists that the message at the heart of the movie is, have faith in God, he'll take care of it. But it's really hard to make don't do anything cinematic.
Despite all that, Nicholson says she's actually hopeful every time she sees a new faith-based film.
I would love to see a film come out of this genre that I think is really intelligent and very smart and very daring. And yes, it can wear its ambitions on its sleeve, its motivations, but it's still in the service of something creative, something that feels like a film and it doesn't feel like a Sunday school lesson.
And the writer of Breakthrough agrees.
From your lips to God's ears. I think as the audience matures, I'm hoping that people, they have to vote with their dollars and actually go put their butts in the seat and see movies that are more challenging.
For The Frame, I'm Colin Friesen.
That's our show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.